From Iowa Public Radio News, this is The Exchange. Sitting in for Ben Kiefer, I'm Alex Hoyer. Census forms are being mailed to millions of households throughout the country. During the first half of the program, I'll talk with a state demographer from Minnesota. During the 2000 census, Iowa had the best return rate, Minnesota was second. I'll also be joined by people who are attempting to get an accurate count in Iowa. During the second half of the show, I'll be joined by a professor of politics at Drake University. We'll talk about how the census will likely affect congressional representation in the state. I'll also be joined by an assistant scientist at Iowa State University. We'll talk about demographic trends. That's all coming up on The Exchange right after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Sitting in for Ben Kiefer, I'm Alex Hoyer. Today we're talking about the census, as forms are being delivered or have already been delivered to millions of households. In a moment, I'll be joined by a state demographer from Minnesota to talk about a friendly competition. I'll also be joined by census leaders in Iowa. But first, we take a look at how the results of the government's once-a-decade population count are especially important for Linn County. The state's second-largest county is on the verge of officially reaching a population level that would put it in a special category for receiving increased federal dollars. However, community leaders are uncertain of how the flood will affect the count. It's mid-morning at the census office in downtown Cedar Rapids. There are about 60 workers here who are responsible for counting the number of people in about one-fifth of the state.
Thank you for calling U.S. Census. This is Carla. How can I help you?
Iowa had the best return rate of any state during the last census count in 2000 at 76%, and David Greedy, who's an enumerator in the Cedar Rapids office, explains trying to get an accurate count is a long process.
We systematically canvass blocks by walking around entire blocks, entire neighborhoods, looking for potential living quarters and making sure that we can count everyone that we can.
Much of that work is complete, but there will likely be a lot of follow-up in flooded neighborhoods. In parts of Cedar Rapids, it's not uncommon to see blocks of homes boarded up. But some families only live on the second floor while rebuilding continues on the lower levels.
It's a tricky situation to determine what to do with those houses. And quite frankly, as an enumerator, we're just eyes on the ground, reporting that that's a particular house that could be habitable.
By late April, census workers will be going door-to-door to houses where a questionnaire was mailed but has not yet been returned. Making sure there's an accurate count is particularly important in Linn County. Supervisor Ben Rogers says the county is almost an entitlement community.
We are very close to a threshold of 200,000 in our population, which would, if we cross it, entitle us to some more federal funds.
A population estimate from right before the flood shows the county had about 208,000 people, and while many county leaders say they expect to stay above the entitlement mark, more than 18,000 people lived in flood-impacted areas. Rogers says staying above 200,000 people is especially important during the bad economy.
18 to 24 months after an event like we had with the flood, you see increases in alcoholism, increases in suicides, increases in people being laid off and requiring more of our services.
For many Iowans, primarily those who live in rural areas and receive their mail through a P.O. box, census forms have always been hand-delivered. And because the devastation experienced throughout Iowa in 2008 was not as widespread as what happened during the hurricanes in Mississippi and Louisiana, the method of delivery has not changed. Dennis Johnson is the regional director of the U.S. Census, located in Kansas City. He says although the method of delivery is not changing in Iowa, he says special efforts are being made to get the word out.
We still have a couple people coming on that will be working in the local communities to talk about the census, the importance of the census, and in particular in the eastern Iowa area, we want to talk about how important it is for the residents to fill out that form and return it as quickly as possible.
Every year, about $400 billion federal dollars go to state and local governments solely based on population. Johnson says he doesn't expect Iowa's return rate to be lower this year because of the disasters. However, that isn't stopping Linn County leaders from stressing the importance of participation as the county remains on the verge of receiving more federal dollars. People can track census form return rates for each state, county, and city by visiting 2010census.gov. A daily update will be posted starting Monday. Joining me now by phone is a neighbor to our north in St. Paul, Minnesota, Barbara Ronigan. She's a demographer at the Minnesota State Demographic Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Now, during the last census in 2000, like we just heard in that piece, Iowa had the best overall return rate at 76%, right behind Iowa at 75% were Wisconsin, Nebraska, and Minnesota. Now, I've learned that there's sort of this friendly competition between Iowa and Minnesota. Why is that?
Well, we all want to have the best response rate. And so, and Minnesota in the past has always been number one, so it was a little bit disheartening for us to be behind Iowa in 2000. So we've been working with our local communities to make sure we're number one in 2010.
Expand a little bit. What kinds of efforts are you doing to make sure that Minnesota can take back that number one spot?
Well, we're doing the same things I'm sure most states are doing. We've held town hall meetings to encourage local communities to form complete count committees. We've met with all sorts of communities throughout the state, both ethnic communities, race communities, councils on the minority populations in Minnesota. We've talked with the newspapers. We've bought publication ads, radio ads. We've got TV PSAs that we produce just for Minnesota. We've produced some materials that we've distributed. To date, we've distributed almost 35,000 census buttons that people can wear and encourage other people to answer the census. We distributed almost 60,000 fortune cookies at parades and festivals all over the state. So a wide variety of activities to raise awareness that the census is coming, that it's important, and it's very easy this time, and that it's safe for people to answer.
The best four states in return rates, like we said, is Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, all four in the Midwest. Why do you think it is that the states in the Midwest typically have the best return rate?
You know, the glib answer would be we try harder, but I also think that we also have the highest voter turnout rates. We seem to be just more civically engaged than other parts of the country. We're concerned with our government, and we want to cooperate, and we want to have influence on the government. And our citizens and our residents know that to do that, they need to vote, and they need to answer the census.
During the second half of this show, we're going to talk about the potential effects of the census on congressional representation in the state of Iowa. What about Minnesota? I would experience that there are similar demographic trends in both states.
Yes. I believe Minnesota's population growth is a little bit faster than Iowa's, but even so, and we're growing at about 6% over this decade, we could lose one of our congressional seats, and of course, no state wants to lose a congressional seat. The latest projections, based on the population estimates released in December of 2009, indicated that Minnesota was 1,100 people short of keeping that 8th congressional seat. So we've been working very hard, because that means we just need 1.5 people in every city, more than they expect we have to keep our seat. And, of course, we're competing with places like California and Texas and Missouri and Iowa for that last seat.
Anything else that you'd like to add as far as Minnesota's efforts in trying to beat Iowa this time around?
Well, we've had a couple of campaigns that have been very, very effective, and I think they've spread out to other states as well. The first one that we started last fall was the Snowbird campaign. We wanted to make sure that Snowbirds knew to answer their census in Minnesota and not to answer the census form that they received at their southern location. And we're finding out that snowbirds stay longer and longer. Many of them don't come back until May, so there's no way for them to get a form in Minnesota when they return. So we've been asking them to go to a questionnaire assistance center or a Be Counted center at their snowbird location, get a blank questionnaire, fill it out with their Minnesota address, and send it back. That way they'll be counted in Minnesota, which is their usual residence, and it is appropriate. So we've done that, and I know that other states have climbed on that bandwagon as well, including New York and Michigan and Indiana. I'm not sure about Iowa, but I would guess that there's been some efforts there as well.
Sure, great. Barbara Ronigan, a demographer at the Minnesota State Demographic Center, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for helping us get this message out.
All right. You're welcome. Joining me now by phone from Cedar Rapids is Daryl Heisler, the manager of the local census office in Cedar Rapids. Welcome to the program. Daryl, are you there?
I'm sorry. Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Okay, great. And also joining me in our studios in Iowa City is Denise Bridges. She's a diversity trainer with Keys to Awareness and also works with the Area Substance Abuse Council there. And she's also spearheading an effort to get an accurate count in African-American churches. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Great. We'll start with you, Denise. What kinds of efforts are you doing to help improve participation in the census?
Well, first of all, we're meeting with African-American leaders in each of the African-American churches, and we're providing incentives like fans and backpacks and mugs and stuff so that as the African-Americans go out into their own community, they will have these things and people will stop and ask them questions. And what I decided to do was to try to have a captain in each of the churches, and they would be responsible to make sure that we would have some information about the census in a bulletin, as well as be a key person when people come up and say, what's the census all about? They can actually explain it. And some of the captains have decided to have a day where people can actually come to their churches with the questionnaire, and they would read the questions and they could answer them there and then mail them. Because we're trying to make sure that everyone understands this is a very important thing, and this can bring lots and lots of dollars back into the African-American community.
So it sounds like just really raising an awareness about the census. You said giving out fans and some other goodies. Let's turn to you, Daryl. What is the census all about? Why is it so important?
It's so important for two basic reasons, and it's power and money. There's $400 billion a year. It is distributed based on, in part, on the count of the people. And it's divided up to the states based on that count. And so if we want to get our fair share of the funds coming from the federal government, we want to count everybody we can. And that affects WIC programs. It affects road construction, hospitals. Businesses use it to see about coming into a community, see if there's a workforce there to work. And it helps us identify things for schools. It hits us on so many levels, and as we heard earlier, it affects our legislative seats in each area. But the big part of it is the funds that come from the federal government that we've already paid in, and we want to just get our fair share back.
All right. We have to take a short break very shortly here. We'll take your calls at 1-866-780-9100. Did you receive your census form in the mail and maybe have a question about it? Perhaps you have questions about the work being done to increase participation in the state. Give us a call at 1-866-780-9100, or you can send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're back after this break. We're back with The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Joining me on this part of the show is Daryl Heisler, the manager of the local census office in Cedar Rapids, also Denise Bridges, who's spearheading an effort to get an accurate count in African American churches. We left off with you, Daryl, talking about the importance of the census. You said power and money. We heard a little bit about this in the piece that we listened to at the beginning of the program, but what are some specific challenges with trying to get an accurate count in disaster-affected communities, not only in Cedar Rapids, but throughout the state?
Well, throughout the state. In the early part of the census operation, I had the eastern part, but we did basically the same things in all areas. We had identified those areas based on historical data of the 2000 census, where there were problems, where we didn't get an accurate response rate, where we didn't feel like areas were counted in. Through our offices and through our partnership offices, and working with people like Denise, we've identified those areas, and in the early stages in operations, we've gone to those places and tried to do as good a job as we can identifying where everybody's living. And for the flood, for us, was a difficult task. But early on, my office, we opened up last October, and my office, we started talking to those communities, finding out where the problems were, and getting in. And as we did our address canvassing, if it looked like someone could live in that house, had a roof, had walls, even though that may have been placard not to do that, we added it to our list to get census forms. And because we want to count everybody and have everybody count.
There is a threat of flooding in the state, and some flooding has already happened. What is the census doing to prepare and maybe some contingency plans?
Well, we're working on a daily basis, paying attention to the National Weather Service and identifying those. And as a matter of fact, we're glad that the levels didn't get as high as projected for this week, but we actually accelerated an early operation where we were taking census forms out to those places that don't get mail. So we're trying to work around those. We've moved up some of our training where we can identify, and then as we pay attention to where the flooding is, and we always have some low-lying flooding in Iowa, but we identify those areas, and if it's projected for flooding, we will move people in sooner and in more number and get to high ground a little bit later and get those low-lying areas first.
All right, let's go to the phones. Deb calling us from Des Moines. Welcome to the program, Deb.
Hello?
Yes, Deb. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just curious as to why it's important or why the question of nationality and race is on the census form. What has that got to do with my getting proper representation or money for my district?
Sure.
Jermaine, if I don't answer that question, does it negate my census?
Sure. Daryl, why is race, nationality, why is that a question on census forms?
We identify, one, you got to remember what the census form is. It's a, and we've heard it on TV and we hear it, it's a snapshot of the country at one time. It identifies areas. We also take census from small babies and from Hispanics and from any nationality where we can identify that certain needs are met. And the school system uses that to identify places they may need more Spanish-speaking. We also identify where perhaps we need more WIC programs or other, maybe more schools because of what's going on. So
what
we're trying to.
What does nationality have to do with being on WIC? I mean, how does that, because one area has more people who are Hispanic, they get more money for things than an area where they're predominantly more Anglo-Saxon.
Well, I don't have
or
anything.
Black or Chinese or.
I don't believe that to be the case. It's
so
really
that's a soundbite.
Well, if
but
I get
maybe
well,
you guys need to identify those.
Deb, let's let Daryl answer the question.
You know, my job in the local census office is to count everyone in where they're living on that date and get an accurate account as I can for the state. It matters because it gives us an idea of what our state looks like and how our state is growing and the needs we have. Beyond that, I don't make the questions, identify the questions, and it helps us identify the people in our country, and that's really what I know about that.
Thanks for the call, Deb. Now, back to you, Denise. You are spearheading this effort in the African-American churches. Does that question of race come up? Is there any hesitancy among the people that you speak with?
Not at this point. We haven't had anybody to question us about it. Pretty much so in the African-American community, it's kind of like a closed closet. And what I mean by that is that a lot of times they don't open the doors to everyone or include other people in their world. So what we were trying to do is to make sure they understand this is a very important paper to fill out. And we thought that most African Americans are affiliated with some type of church. And we hope that that would help them to fill out the form so they could be counted and accurate.
And we should point out that they're not just efforts to get high levels of participation in African-American churches, but also among all types
churches.
Of populations.
Absolutely.
Many churches, many other regions, community mm-hmm. groups.
Mm-hmm.
And that just brings us back to the level of partnership. Talk a little bit more about the partnership that goes on into increasing participation, not only in the African-American churches.
Oh, absolutely. In the Linn County Count committee that I'm a part of, they have people that are working with the aging as far as the Asian community. They have people that are working with a senior citizen population. They're trying to make sure that everyone is covered. So they're even projecting like people that are in nursing homes so that they can be counted for. We're looking at the college students. So we're just trying to every avenue that you could think of, every ethnic group that you can think of, we are trying to include them so that everyone knows everyone must be counted.
So are you satisfied with the levels of participation that you're getting as of now?
Oh, absolutely, because the more and more people that have joined our committee, the more and more it's been able to spread out. And every meeting we try to identify, is there any area that we have forgotten so that we can make sure that everyone's counted?
All right. Let's go to the phones again. We have Tony calling us from West Des Moines. Tony, are you there? Sounds like Tony isn't with us. Sorry about that. We have an email from Nancy. She writes, I hear Iowa City has concerns that because of the college student population, the census numbers will not be as high as they should be. What about that, Daryl? What special things do you do to accommodate the colleges throughout the state?
We, in each of our offices, we know when the semester is over, and it's a we handle the local community by perhaps starting the census early if we feel if it's a problem, if the times interfere. We're also about to go out into the group quarters is what we call it, but all the dormitories and stuff, we'll be doing the census in those buildings here starting in about 2 weeks on the 1st. So we're going to be out in those buildings on campus doing the census early, and then in those communities where school is going to be over, not graduation, but when the classes are over, before finals are over, we're going to be in those communities getting the census done. It's a very good question. We spent some time researching and making sure that we're covering that.
What about homeless people? Certainly they are people living in this country, and I believe that they are included in the census, but how?
Well, everyone is included, and we make a special effort, and we work with county agencies and individuals that work with the homeless, and they actually work with us, and over a four-day period, we will go out to all those locations and visit those locations, soup kitchens, go out to where they are, and we will take the census from those people also. And most of the time, we find, contrary to popular belief, they very much want to be part of something, and they're very helpful when we're doing the census. Because everybody that wants to feel part of it, and they are affected and are perhaps helped by the information we gather more than anyone.
Sure. Briefly, in about 20 seconds or so, what is the timeline? When will the census end?
Well, the census will end December 31st of 2010, and when the Department of Commerce gives their report to the president. But our work here in the local area will probably finish in September. It depends on how much non-response we have to the initial mailing, and we try to get everyone to mail as quickly as possible.
Okay, great. Thank you. My guests have been Daryl Heisler, the manager of the local census office in Cedar Rapids. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Denise Bridges, a diversity trainer with Keys to Awareness and also working with the Area Substance Abuse Council in Cedar Rapids, spearheading an effort to get an accurate count in African American churches. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. On the second half of the show, we'll talk about demographic trends in Iowa and how the census will affect congressional representation. We're back after this break. And for Ben Kiefer today, I'm Alex Hoyer. During this half of the show, we're going to talk about how the census will likely affect congressional representation and some other political factors. We're also going to talk about demographic trends in the state. Joining me now from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames is Liesl Effington, an assistant scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Also joining me by phone is Dennis Goldford, a professor of politics at Drake University. He's the co-author of a book that will be released this fall by University of Iowa Press, the new edition of the Iowa Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We'd also like to take your calls and emails. Do you have a question about how the census will affect political representation? What about changes in Iowa's population or some other demographic trends? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. or send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. I'd like to start with you, Professor Goldford. There is talk about Iowa losing one of its 5 congressional seats in the U.S. House as a result of the census. Is there any truth to that?
Oh, it's pretty much of a certainty. The Census Bureau in December of 2008 started to say that it was likely this would occur. So the problem is that Iowa's population has grown only marginally, and certainly relative to the way population has changed in other states, it's fallen behind. When we talk about the congressional districts, we have to remember that there are 435 districts in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's the result of a kind of political or historical accident. From the first Congress in 1789 until 1910, every time there was a constitutionally mandated census and reapportionment, what would happen would be that Congress would simply add new congressional seats to each state. But in 1910, they hit the number of 435. And then in 1920, when it came time for them to consider new seats, people started to be concerned that the House of Representatives was becoming too large. And so the number was frozen later in the decade of the 20s at 435, which means that if for any state with increasing population to gain a seat, some other state has to lose a seat so that the net change is zero.
We'll get to more about congressional representation in just a bit, but I want to turn to you, Liesl. We've learned that Iowa's population is growing, but just more slowly than in other states. Why is that?
Well, we see really the biggest problem for Iowa is a high rate of domestic outmigration. So we're losing our residents to other states. We are growing from natural population growth, which means simply we have more people being born than are dying. But because we're losing these people to other states in the U.S., our overall growth is not keeping up with the U.S. average.
Where are Iowans going then?
Well, they probably start out by going to nearby metros, maybe Chicago or Twin Cities, St. Louis. We see a lot of that with our younger adults. But they're also going to the more rapidly growing parts of the country, like the mountain states. And during this previous decade, we saw a lot of people moving to the southeastern states as well.
What about the difference between the rural portions of Iowa and the metro areas?
It's a huge difference. The net growth in our state is about a third of the rate of the U.S. But if we look at the growth within the state, we're seeing pretty much all of it occurring in our metro areas, and our non-metro areas actually have been losing population this decade. And even before, this is an ongoing trend for Iowa.
So the metro areas, are they gaining less population than other metro areas like Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, or is it about in line with the rate at which those cities are growing?
If we look at Midwestern metros, Iowa's metros are doing pretty well. But if we look at all U.S. metros, we're really lagging behind.
Professor Goldford, when these political representation lines are redrawn, what is that process going to be like?
Well, Iowa's system is actually quite admired from outside the state. We have something called the Legislative Services Bureau, and it's nonpartisan. And you have a number of people who run their computer programs and put together potential congressional districts based upon various criteria. The first and foremost one, of course, is that they have to have an equal number of people in them so far as possible because of the U.S. Supreme Court's requirement of one person, one vote. So in theory, if there are 3 million people in Iowa and if we have just 4 districts, each one should contain 750,000 people. Now, that's complicated somewhat by the fact that there's a requirement that political subdivisions be respected. So what that means in Iowa is that you can't break up a county and put a county into 2 different congressional districts, although that doesn't apply to, say, a natural kind of socioeconomic area take the Des Moines metro area, for example. Dallas County, just to the west of Polk County, is certainly part of the Des Moines metro area. It's where a lot of the growth has occurred in the past 10 or 20 years. And yet, after the 2000 census, that was split off from Polk County and put in the 4th district, which angles up in kind of a reverse comma or reverse apostrophe toward northeastern Iowa. But still, the county lines are respected. Districts also have to be contiguous and compact. So the whole point is you can't get some of these things that these oddly shaped districts, the results of partisan gerrymanders in other states.
And this initiative in the state of Iowa, because certainly there are other states. I came from the state of Illinois, and there are some congressional districts that are not contiguous that look like a snake running throughout the state.
Right. There was an infamous district in North Carolina that was called sometimes the I-95, the Interstate 95 district, because the claim was if you drove down Interstate 95 in Florida, the interstate that runs from the northeast down to Miami, if you drove down that the middle of the road, the interstate in North Carolina, with your both passenger and driver's doors open, you'd hit everybody who lived in the district because it basically followed the interstate. Ours can't do that. But at the same time, just to reaffirm the point about the different population densities, when you've got to have include counties and respect county lines as well as city lines, but especially county lines, and you've got to have equal numbers of people. With the 2000 census, for example, you have the 5th district contains 32 counties in western Iowa. Each of the other 4 districts, 1 through 4, contains anywhere from 12 to 15 counties. So in other words, you needed 32 counties after the 2000 census to get as many people as you'd find in 12 to 15 counties in central and eastern Iowa. And that, again, is because the population's so thin in those areas. So this will make it very interesting this time around if we're going to go down to 4 districts.
How so? How would it make it interesting?
Well, you're really going to have to have some creatively drawn districts, again, respecting county lines, in order to encompass enough people, since, again, population is so thinly dispersed and it's so thin, it's not very densely populated in west central and western Iowa, that if you need approximately 750,000 people, that's the question. How will this bureau draw these districts? Where will they fit Des Moines, for example, and its suburbs? After the 1990 census, for example, prior to that, Des Moines in the 4th district used to be pretty much like this circle in the middle of the state. It was fairly compact and very central. But after the 1990 census, Story County was split off from there, and the 4th district was shoved west along I-80 and extended all the way to Council Bluffs. And then we've got this back, now the 3rd district that includes Des Moines. It's really more Des Moines and some of eastern Iowa. So, again, you've got to juggle all these factors, and the political problem, of course, is what happens to the 5 representatives who are there.
Mm. I can foresee that when these lines are redrawn, there will likely be 2 incumbents going against each other. When the lines are redrawn, is it strictly based on geography, or does who's in office make a difference?
Well, in theory, who's in office is not supposed to make a difference. After the 2000 census, again, the Legislative Services Agency or Bureau comes up with a redistricting plan, and it can be discussed and debated in the legislature, and they have to have an up or down vote on it. And if they reject it, then the Bureau has to go back and come up with a second plan. This was done in 2000. They had to go to a second plan because Republicans objected to the way the lines were drawn. They thought it favored Democrats too much. But there can't be any kind of overt gerrymandering in the Iowa system the way there can be in other states. You've got to work with the plans that this Bureau gives you. Typically, what the parties have done is gone ahead and hope that the two weakest, the lowest seniority people in each party would be thrown in a district together. That's what happened when we went from 6 to 5 districts in 1990. Dave Nagel and Jim Nussel from eastern Iowa were tossed into the same district, Nagel Democrat, Nussel Republican, and Nussel beat Nagel. This time around, you've got 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. And with only 4 districts, it's hard to see how they're going to do that. That's the interesting part, to see what happens.
because Congressman Steve King, a Republican, is out west, and then you have Congressman Braley and Loebsack in the east, who are both Democrats.
Right, and Loebsack and Braley are the least senior members of the Iowa House delegation. Mm-hmm. King's been there a little bit longer than they have.
All right. Feel free to give us a call if you have a question, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. How do you feel that Iowa's changing population will affect political representation? Will Iowa maybe lose some of its stature? Or do you have a question about where Iowans are moving? Give us a call, 866-780-9100, or send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Let's turn to you, Liesl, now. We've talked about how the population is moving, how the rural communities in Iowa are actually losing population. When did all of that really begin?
It's actually been happening for quite some time. We had about 43 counties in Iowa reached their peak population size in the year 1900 or before. And another 42 peaked sometime between 1910 and 1980. So we only have 14 counties in the state that were bigger in 2000 than they ever had been before. So it's really a persistent trend that we've been seeing in Iowa and in the Midwest in general.
Is it most severe in Iowa, or maybe in a different Midwest state, or is it a common thread throughout all the Midwest, like you said?
It's a common thread, and then I think that the recent recession might be compounding some of this flow of people into metro areas and out of the rural areas. But then we kind of see the reverse in Ohio. We're seeing massive losses in some of their metro areas, and the same thing in Michigan. So I think the results of the census should be pretty interesting to see if we're seeing toward the end of the decade shifts in that longer-term trend that we've been watching.
Why are people in the rural part of the state going closer to cities given the recession?
Well, they may have lost their jobs in the rural areas and view their employment opportunities just to be much stronger in the metro areas simply because they're bigger, they have a more diverse economy, and it could be that they have, you know, relatives there or other support networks that are accessible in metro areas that aren't as accessible in our more sparsely populated areas.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Liesl Ethington, an assistant scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Also, Dennis Goldford, a professor of politics at Drake University. Now, turning to you, Professor, as Iowa becomes less prominent with federal representation, even though it is just one congressional seat, how do you see that impacting Iowa's influence in perhaps the nation and in Washington, D.C.?
Well, Congress does still function in terms of seniority to a great extent. So Iowa's congressional representation, I should say Iowa's House representation, is relatively unsenior, relatively junior. Braley, Loebsack, King are not; they don't have great seniority yet. Latham's got a little more, Boswell's got a little more, but nobody's been there more than maybe seven terms or so at this particular point. I mean, contrast that with how many years Neil Smith was there until he was defeated by Greg Ganske in 1994. And there are two keys in the House to influence. One is seniority, and one is having your party have a majority in the chambers. So if you're in a senior, if you have seniority in your party, and your party controls the chamber, you can be a committee or a subcommittee chairman, and that makes a big difference. I haven't checked recently. I would imagine that Boswell, Braley, and Loebsack have at least a subcommittee chair at some place at this point, whereas King and Latham, as members of the majority, wouldn't. They might be a ranking member, the most senior person of the minority party on a committee or subcommittee, but they wouldn't have a chair at this point. Really, at this point, Iowa, as a smaller state, has whatever clout it has, just the way North Dakota and Wyoming and Delaware has. And that's in the Senate. and you've got two rather senior senators, Senator Harkin and Senator Grassley, who are in very dominant positions there. And I think so Iowa's congressional clout at this point rests mostly with the senators of each party rather than in the House.
Hmm. How about losing federal representation impacting Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucus status?
I don't think the two are connected tremendously. I mean, one of the standard arguments about the against the caucuses that people outside Iowa make is that Iowa's not very representative of the country as a whole. It's older, it's wider, it's less diverse, it's more agricultural than the nation as a whole. To the extent that we lose a seat, and a lot of it is because, as Liesl said about out-migration of younger folks, again, that does make us a little older and sharpens a little bit some of the arguments about our being not representative because the Iowa population is older than the national average. But I don't see any direct impact at this point.
Let's go to Craig in Cedar Rapids. Craig, you're on the air. What's your comment or question?
Hi, thanks. Well, I'd rather see Iowa become the best-kept secret in the nation than to end up like some of these cities with a lot of crime and everything else that nobody wants to live in. And if the rural community is losing people, then Congress is going to have to make sure that they're represented somehow in Washington, even though they have a smaller population.
There were two parts to that. The first was the rural communities need to make sure that they do have some representation. Professor Goldford, what are the rules about a minimum of congressional representation that has to happen? Of course, there are two Senate seats per state, but what about the House?
Well, certainly in the House, you have 435 seats. 50 go automatically, one to each state. That leaves 385 to be apportioned based upon population. There's a complex formula for doing that. So, say, North Dakota wouldn't get any of those 385. It's just got one representative at large. We will get, if we do lose the seat, it seems almost certain, we'll get three of those, whereas California may get at least 52 or more of those, something like that. But on the point about the rural side, the apportionment doesn't really make a difference or doesn't look at those differences within a state. Indeed, one of the reasons for the Supreme Court decisions in the 1960s mandating one person and one vote were that the rural areas were overrepresented, both in the U.S. House and in state legislatures. In other words, there were fewer people even back then, but they had a greater number of representatives than on a one-person, one-vote basis they should have had.
The second part of Craig's comment was about keeping Iowa the best-kept secret and keeping out crime. Liesl, when you do demographic research, do you consider things like crime?
A lot of people do put crime into their massive indexes of best places to live. You can find those rankings for metropolitan areas or for individual states, and there are dozens and dozens of them. Crime is just one of them. They look at educational attainment, just a lot of different factors. So, yes, we do look at that.
What are some other interesting demographic trends that are going on?
Well, I think back to a point that was made earlier about Iowa not being representative of the U.S., if we look at the composition of our recent employment growth just this decade, but we look at it by race and ethnicity, what we find is that our non-Hispanic white population, which is what we would typically associate with Iowa, it actually has decreased this decade by almost 4,000 people. So all of our net growth as a state has either been among the Hispanic population or people whose race is some other race than white.
Comment more on the amount of people from other countries that are coming to the state. Is that increasing? Is it decreasing? What are we seeing there?
Our international migration, when I said earlier that we were on net losing people to other states, some of that loss is being offset by gains from international migration. So that's been a really important source of growth for Iowa, and not just in our metropolitan counties. It's actually been maybe the only source of growth in some of our non-metropolitan areas.
Hmm.
Liz, go ahead.
No, feel free to go ahead, Professor Goldberg.
I would add, yes, we certainly have an increasingly diverse population. I mean, if you go to the Des Moines Farmers Market on a Saturday morning in the summer, you're astounded by the diversity of people there. And just since I've come to Iowa, I'm not a native Iowan, I've seen an increase in that diversity. At the same time, Iowa remains, I think, among the top five whitest states in the nation out of 50.
Back to what Craig's comment was getting at with this crime and population, is there a direct correlation between the two? The more people you have, the more crime that there's going to be?
Well, we do tend to see higher crime rates in more urbanized areas. And so as Iowa grows increasingly metropolitan, which we are doing, much like the rest of the United States, we might see increases in crime rates. But as far as, you know, causality, no. I think it's just more people maybe in a broader spectrum of income levels that you do see higher incidence of crime.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have come to the end of the show. My guests have been Liesl Ethington, an assistant scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Great. Also, thanks to Dennis Goldford, a professor of politics at Drake University, also co-author of a book that will be released this fall, the new edition of The Iowa Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Dennis Reese and Jonathan All. Podcasting and on-demand audio from The Exchange available by going to Iowa Public Radio. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer. Thanks for joining us.